Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, August 15, 2022. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern. Today we're starting at 8:30. If you're listening live over our radio or another network, you can, and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can go to nationallibertyalliance.org and click on our weekly call for instructions to join us by phone, app, or browser. Well, if anyone would like, they can email a question by sending them to questions, it's questions plural, questions at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save our republic. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, I want to pick up where we left off last week on our scripture reading. We're in the Gospel of John. We're in the last chapter of John. I don't think I opened up my Bible yet. That's going to take a minute. So give me a second. All right, well, while that's opening up, I'll just quickly talk about this evening's program. Tonight we started earlier because I want to play a video, a very important video, I think. I was really impressed by it when I first saw it. It's 54 minutes long, and sometimes when we play a video, I like to try to do it less than 30 minutes. But this is going to be 54 minutes. That's why we started early this week. And the ultimate focus is the essential of a value of a classical education. And a classical education gets into the great conversations. There's many sides of discussion on that. So, you know, there's many sides. But the focus of a classical education is on subject matters such as justice, God, the human spirit, heart, the soul, nature, ethics, law, Leviathan, and the necessity of a king. And that's an interesting one. One of the conversations was about the necessity of a king. Of course, he was talking about an earthly king. We know the necessity of a heavenly king, the king of the universe, the king of our courts. Justice courts are not possible. Natural law courts are not possible unless there's a king to that court who governs with his law. And that, of course, is God himself. But going back to the great conversation, some of the books like Locke, Hume, Blackstone, Berkeley, Spinoza, and most importantly, the Bible. The Bible is part of that conversation. It's part of the great books. It is the book that we really should first and foremost, and I think that's why founding fathers built their education around the Bible. Many people don't realize that, but schools up through the 1800s, as it came before to the 20th century, the Bible was the key focus of education. People learned to read from the Bible and many other things. And it's important to really have a relationship with that Bible because it helps us to navigate through all of the other conversations. It gives us an anchor in life. Our founding documents are part of that great conversation. As a matter of fact, they're the product of that great conversation. The Federalist Papers is the debate that created our founding documents. The law, the book The Law and Common Sense, two of those books were part of the great conversation. So we as a people, our heritage is built upon the great conversation, ultimately focusing, of course, and built upon the Word of God. And that's who we are as a people. You know, there are a couple of dictionaries, Black's Law Dictionary and Bouvier's Law. And to some degree, I think that's part of the great books also, because really it's a dictionary, and it gets you through the law part, and law is everything of what we're talking about, and the importance of this great conversation, and the importance of our involvement in this great conversation. The science of government is our focus, and I see we're opened up. Let me get the Bible going. We'll read our Bible chapter for tonight. We're going to be in the last chapter of John. I believe it's chapter 21. take a little bit to get this open. Yep, there we go. Okay. Okay, the Gospel of John, read by Alexander Scorby, chapter 21.
Chapter 21. After these things, Jesus showed himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias, and from this point he showed himself. There were together Simon Peter, and Thomas called Didymus, and Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, and the sons of Zebedee, and two other
disciples. It's so low, John. I can't hear it.
You're not hearing any of that?
No.
Terry, are you hearing? Let me pause it for a moment.
I'm hearing almost nothing. I can hear somebody talking way in the background. I can't understand a word it's saying.
Okay, you did hear the music, though, coming in, right?
No, I didn't hear the music at first. I sent that to you.
Oh, well, I didn't hear that either. I don't know why that is. Obviously, we're not getting a decent... I guess we're coming through okay, huh? So, I don't know. I guess we're getting a recording?
Yeah, the recording of the broadcaster is not working right.
All right. What I'm going to do is bail out and come back in. We'll just pick up on the gospel reading. Give me a moment to bail out and come in. Maybe on... I know I was in there the week before last... last week, I think it was, and I lowered the volumes on something because I thought they were too high. But I went back in. They looked like they were all back up. All right, let me see if the recording's moving on.
Recorded.
All right, we'll pick back up where we had cut off before. All right, let me see if I can share the screen here. You know what, I may have just fixed this because restarting it, I clicked on Share Computer Sound. Maybe that'll fix the problem. Let me click on Start Sharing. Okay, let me know when you see the screen.
Nothing
yet, huh? Well, let me stop it again, and let me try to start it again. Okay, let's try that. How's that?
Nothing.
Give it a second. I see the green bar.
Nice. Your screen.
Okay, so now let's see if video is going to come through now. I'm sure I'd press that button, but maybe not. Are you hearing that?
Yeah, I see it and I hear it.
Okay. All right, well, let us, at first, before we get started, go back to our gospel reading, and we'll start there.
Chapter 21. After these things, Jesus showed himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias, and on this wise showed he himself.
That's coming through now, right?
Yes, it's coming through.
Okay.
There were together Simon Peter, and Thomas called Didymus, and Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, and the sons of Zebedee, and two other of his disciples. Simon Peter saith unto them, I go a-fishing. They say unto him, We also go with thee. They went forth, and entered into a ship immediately. And that night they caught nothing. But when the morning was now come, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples knew not that it was Jesus. Then Jesus saith unto them, Children, have ye any meat? They answered him, No. And he said unto them, Cast the net on the right side of the ship, and ye shall find. They cast therefore, and now they were not able to draw it for the multitude of fishes. Therefore that disciple whom Jesus loved saith unto Peter, It is the Lord. Now when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he girt his fisher's coat unto him, for he was naked, and did cast himself into the sea. And the other disciples came in a little ship, for they were not far from land, but as it were 200 cubits, dragging the net with fishes. As soon then as they were come to land, they saw a fire of coals there, and fish laid thereon, and bread. Jesus saith unto them, Bring of the fish which ye have now caught. Simon Peter went up and drew the net to land full of great fishes, 153. And for all there were so many, yet was not the net broken. Jesus saith unto them, Come and dine. And none of the disciples durst ask him, Who art thou, knowing that it was the Lord? Jesus then cometh, and taketh bread, and giveth them, and fish likewise. This is now the third time that Jesus showed himself to his disciples after that he was risen from the dead. So when they had dined, Jesus saith to Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me more than these? He saith unto him, Yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. He saith unto him, Feed my lambs. He saith to him again the second time, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? He saith unto him, Yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. He saith unto him, Feed my sheep. He saith unto him the third time, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? Peter was grieved, because he said unto him the third time, Lovest thou me? And he said unto him, Lord, thou knowest all things, thou knowest that I love thee. Jesus saith unto him, Feed my sheep. Verily, verily, I say unto thee, When thou wast young, thou girdest thyself, and walkest whither thou wouldest. But when thou shalt be old, thou shalt stretch forth thy hands, and another shall gird thee, and carry thee whither thou wouldest not. This spake he, signifying by what death he should glorify God. And when he had spoken this, he saith unto him, Follow me. Then Peter, turning about, seeth the disciple whom Jesus loved following, which also leaned on his breast at supper, and said, Lord, which is he that betrayeth thee? Peter, seeing him, saith to Jesus, Lord, and what shall this man do? Jesus saith unto him, If I will that he tarry till I come, what is that to thee? Follow thou me. Then went this saying abroad among the brethren, that that disciple should not die. Yet Jesus said not unto him, He shall not die, but if I will that he tarry till I come, what is that to thee? This is the disciple which testifieth of these things, and wrote these things. And we know that his testimony is true. And there are also many other things which Jesus did, the which, if they should be written every one, I suppose that even the world itself could not contain the books that should be written. Amen. The end of the Gospel according to St. John.
Okay, we'll pick up our program where we were just starting. We'll play the video and let me know if the video isn't, if the audio is not coming through, let me know. But let's play this video. Again, this is an extremely important video in my opinion, and all of us should be aware of the conclusion that this video is going to bring to us, because this is what it's all about. Okay.
What is the best sort of life for a human being? Socrates claimed in 400 BC that a man lives a happier life if he's just, even if he's thrown starving into prison for the rest of his life, than if he's unjust and he's celebrated and honored all of his days and is never caught for his crimes. Could that possibly be correct? If not, why not? And what difference should the question make to us now? What moves the human heart? Shakespeare's characters throw us into the depths of lust, envy, greed, pride, ambition. What do those characters have to say about the way that we act, or that we behave, or that we believe? And if so, what difference would it make to read about them in Shakespeare? And why Shakespeare, who is Elizabethan English, is very difficult for us who speak modern English to understand. Thomas Hobbes wrote in 1651 a book called Leviathan, one of the two or three most influential works in the history of thinking about government and politics in Western society. He was writing from the midst of a raging civil war, and he argued that unless we gave all the power, unless we surrendered all ultimate control to a legitimate king, that we would all rob and kill each other. Was he right about that? Is that the way things actually work? And is the question relevant to us today when we no longer believe in kings? Hello, my name is Jeff Brenzel, and I'm the Dean of Undergraduate Admissions at Yale University. I lecture from time to time in the philosophy department at Yale, and my work in philosophy centers around ethics and also the history of the ideas that we've had about something we like to call human nature. Speaking of human nature, one of my personal heroes, Aristotle, claimed that by nature, everyone seeks to know, everyone desires to know. For the purposes of this talk, I'm going to assume that you are already an intellectually curious person, and that you're not only chasing after knowledge as hard as you can, you're also trying to build up the skill sets and acquire the kind of capacities and abilities that you're going to need to become a better learner overall. If these things are in fact true about you, then here's my advice in a nutshell. Make a choice in college to read some old books, even a substantial number of old books. My argument will be that reading the right old books in the right way is better than reading only new books, much less using only new ways of learning that have nothing to do with books at all. But let's be careful about what I'm claiming and what I'm not claiming. I'm not claiming that you should read only old books, or that old books are better because they're old, or that you should never read any new books, or that new books are worthless. Only that you should read and learn how to read some old books. But which ones would those be? How do you learn how to read them in the right way? Why should you read them in college? And how could doing that change your life for the better? How is that going to make you smarter? And moreover, how's it going to make you wiser? The dialogues of Socrates, Aristotle's Ethics, Oedipus Rex, The City of God, Leviathan, Dante's Inferno, King Lear, Paradise Lost, War and Peace. There are a lot of these books. But why spend a significant amount of your time on books that by definition are outdated? Why not go after the books that bring everything up to date? Don't we know everything those people already knew and much, much more? So a little personal background here. I went off to university in 1971. No one in my family had ever graduated from college, much less a place like Yale. I'd never visited across the state line. I never had even been on an airplane before the one that swept me off to New Haven, Connecticut. Now, when I actually showed up at Yale, I applied in total ignorance and almost by accident to a special freshman year program called Directed Studies. So what is Directed Studies? In Directed Studies, you take three full-year courses in the history of Western thought, in philosophy, in literature, and in politics. You start with what the classic Greeks had to say, and then you roll forward with the centuries until you end up about a century behind where we are right now. There's no textbooks, there's no summaries, there's no cliff notes. You read only the original works. And it was both the single most difficult and the single most transforming educational experience that I've ever had. about 15 years ago, I came back to Yale after founding companies, managing organizations, and after earning a PhD in philosophy. And I'm having the opportunity there today to teach in this very same program that I took over 30 years ago. So I've gotten to know these classic works fairly well. I've become familiar with them. I've seen their effects on students. And I've had the chance to stack them up against my own life experience and stuff that I've read from lots of modern books. So here I am, ready to give you some good reasons to look into the classics yourself. Now, the first thing to point out is something that I think you already know. There are a lot of books out there, and you don't have much time. The Library of Congress has over 20 million volumes. That's the largest library in the world. That's not counting the journals, the publications. It's not counting the internet. It's not counting the blogs. It's not counting Wikipedia. It's not counting the entire Googleplex. Meanwhile, down here on the personal level, I'm 58 years old. I've been a pretty strong reader for about 40 years. Back home, I've got a personal library of about 2,000 books, volumes. And if you do the math, that's about 50 books times 40 years, about 50 books a year. It's about a book a week. I hope you can see the problem. My problem, which is also your problem, which is we ain't going to make it through the Library of Congress. Not only that, we're not going to get to 99.999% of everything that's ever been written. You know, Mahatma Gandhi said, live as though you'll die tomorrow, but learn as though you'll live forever. Gandhi was as aware as you and I are that we're not going to live forever. And of course, that means that you are going to have to be extremely picky about what you choose to read, even if you live according to Gandhi. You literally have no other choice. But now it seems I've only made my job harder because I've got to persuade you that with this precious time that you have for learning and study, which is dwindling all the time, that you're going to take some of it and devote it to things that are outdated. So let's focus on the principle of necessity, and that means the principle of having to make these difficult and time-consuming choices. I'd like to give you five reasons, five rough and ready criteria for identifying a classic of literature or philosophy or politics. Now, no one or two of these criteria are going to be decisive, but I think if you put them all together, they're going to prove actually to be quite useful. First, the work addresses a permanent, universal concern about the human condition. From the philosophical perspective, it has something to say about the way we should live. From a literary perspective, it helps us imagine different ways that we could live. And from a political perspective, or an historical perspective, it helps us remember ways that we have lived. So that's mark number one of a classic. Mark number two is that the work has been a game changer. It changed perspective or shifted perspective on those issues, both for the earliest people who read the book and also for those who came later. Mark number three is that the work has stimulated or provoked or responded to many other important works. Mark number four is that many generations of the very best readers and the most expert critics have rated the work highly as one of the best and most important of its kind, even if those reviewers, those experts, didn't agree on anything else, and even if they took or had a violent argument with the work itself. Mark number five is that the work usually does require a strenuous effort to both engage it and understand it, but rewards that great effort in multiple ways and very highly. Before we think about what these criteria rule in, let's think about what they rule out. Let's say that you run up to me with a novel that you picked up just last week. You wave it in the air and you say, Professor Brenzel, I've got a great book here for you. It's an instant classic, even better than Moby Dick, maybe even better than Moby Dick. What am I likely to respond? Well, it may be, in fact, very good. And your recommendation may persuade me to read it, particularly if I have a high opinion of you as an expert reader. Your new favorite book may, in fact, become a classic someday. But it hasn't changed the game as yet for other writers and readers. It hasn't provoked or influenced lots of other works. How could it? You don't know how experts and other readers are going to evaluate it over time. You're not even sure how you're going to see the book over time. But let's remember the critical problem that we all have. Way too many books and not nearly enough time. So where are you likely to get the biggest bang for your reading dollar and for your reading hour? Something published last week or something that stood the centuries of tests by tough readers and that has in fact spawned a great deal of what you'll be reading today? So I'm sort of defining a classic as an old book. It's been through generations of readers, big game-changing ideas, and something that you can expect to find to be a considerable challenge to tackle. So let's flesh it out with just a few examples before we talk about what good it's going to do you to read such a book in a college course. Socrates was a philosopher who lived in Athens, ancient Greece, about 400 years before the birth of Christ. You've probably heard his name, even if you know nothing else about him. You may also know that the other citizens of Athens put him to death because he went around asking a lot of challenging questions, needling people, irritating them with questions about their actions and their beliefs that they didn't care to answer. Well, it's a remarkable fact that for the past 24 centuries, very few thinkers in the Western tradition have been able to avoid having to come at some point to grips with Socrates and his life and his death. It's even more interesting that Socrates, so far as we know, never actually wrote down a single word. He strolled around the town, embarrassing prominent people with his questions. He liked to say that the only superiority that he ever claimed was that he was absolutely certain that he was ignorant, but he found that people believed that they knew all kinds of things, and in that, he was superior to them. Now, one of the young aristocrats who got a big charge out of following Socrates around the town was a young wrestler named Plato, maybe the first scholar athlete. So Plato wrote a series of dialogues after Socrates died that featured his hero in the principal role. The early dialogues do seem to reflect for us this business of walking around asking these difficult questions that no one can answer. Later, in the later dialogues, Plato begins to use Socrates as a mouthpiece or as someone who represents the kinds of new questions that Plato himself began to ask under Socrates' inspiration. To give you some indication of how expert readers over time have understood Plato's thought and its central importance in the tradition, the great 20th century philosopher and mathematician Alfred North Whitehead once said that all of Western thought is nothing more than a series of footnotes to Plato. Quite a claim. And remember that it was Plato's encounter with Socrates that inspired all of Plato's thought. Now, Plato's single most important dialogue with Socrates as the hero is a dialogue called The Republic. And in it, Plato tries to formulate two basic, fundamental, and universal questions. What's the best sort of life for a human being? And beyond that, what's the best society for producing the conditions under which human beings could live that kind of life? These two questions give the book the first mark of greatness that I was discussing, which is the Republic addresses permanent and universal questions, ones that might puzzle you as much as they did Socrates and Plato. The book opens with a really terrific argument about justice, whether it's the just or the unjust person who gets the better of it in life. Socrates confronts a very sarcastic and very aggressive young man named Thrasymachus, who attacks the common notion that justice is a virtue. "Listen then," says Thrasymachus, "I proclaim that might is right, and that justice, as you call it, is whatever happens to be in the interest of the stronger. There are different forms of government, but they all make laws according to their own interests. Everywhere there is only one principle of so-called justice, which is that justice turns out to be whatever happens to be in the interest of the stronger." So, have you ever heard someone make this argument before? That might makes right, that justice has no fixed meaning, that what is considered just in a society is just whatever the people running the society say it is? I'd be surprised if you hadn't, because it's a universally recurring argument, not only throughout the dorms of any good colleges down through time, but also down through the centuries in the debates of the very best philosophers. Now, I can't do justice in this short talk to even this relatively simple opening framing argument of the Republic between Thrasymachus and Socrates. But essentially, Socrates tries to answer Thrasymachus by pointing out that we distinguish between good rulers and bad rulers, just like we distinguish between good shepherds and bad shepherds, or good boat captains and bad boat captains. The good shepherds act in the best interests of the sheep, and the good boat captains act in the best interests of their boats and passengers. So a ruler, if he's rightly named a ruler or she's rightly named a ruler, is someone who acts in the best interest of the subjects, and the bad ones don't. Thrasymachus calls this drivel. He points out that the shepherd hardly cares for the sheep. He's simply fattening them for the slaughter. "Consider further, most foolish Socrates," he says, "that the just is always a loser in comparison with the unjust. First of all, in private matters, wherever the unjust is the partner of the just, you will find that the unjust man always gains more and the just man always gets less. Next, in their dealings with the government, when there is an income tax, the just man will pay more and the unjust man less on the same amount of income. And when there is anything to be received, the one gains nothing, the other gains much." By this standard, Thrasymachus goes on to say, the best life is actually the one to be had by the absolute tyrant, who can take anything that he wishes by force and make everyone else pay honor and obedience. So not only is being a tyrant the best kind of life, all people would become tyrants if only they could. Now Socrates at this point knocks Thrasymachus down with some verbal and logical tricks that I'm not going to take you through in this talk. And outwitted, Thrasymachus stalks off from the conversation not to return. The young friends of Socrates are not satisfied with this outcome, and they take up the core question, but in a much harder form. They ask Socrates to prove to them that the just person is always happier and always has a better life than the unjust person, no matter how poor, deprived, disgraced, or reviled the just man might be, and no matter how wealthy, honored, and completely unharmed an unjust man might be. So the rest of the Republic is Plato's attempt to answer this question along with a number of other questions. In the course of it, he draws a surprisingly compelling picture of human psychology. He speculates on the nature of knowledge. He presents a proposal for the ideal state, and he polishes it all off with a theory about enlightenment and about the ultimate nature of reality. Along the way, he speculates about the relations between men and women, how to raise and educate children to be good citizens, and the right way for human beings to investigate questions of all kinds. Now, Plato himself had a brilliant student named Aristotle, who, for my money, actually surpassed Plato in a number of different ways, but was certainly heavily influenced by Plato. So let me just give you a very quick notion of how things play out in the history of thought for Plato's and Aristotle's thinking, and in fact, for your own. First, their thinking stays very much alive in Greece and Rome for 400 years until the coming of Christ, and beyond that for many centuries more. If you happen to be a Christian, what you think of as Christianity, the very concepts and ideas that form the basis for Christianity, actually turn out to owe a great deal to Plato and Aristotle. Virtually everything that Christianity teaches about God, about human nature, about human fulfillment, arises from what the historians of religion like to call the marriage of Jerusalem and Athens. That is, the marriage of Greek and Jewish thinking. One big moment for this process comes about 8 centuries after Plato and Aristotle, 4 centuries after Christ, when a man named St. Augustine writes a truly monumental work in the history of Western thought, a real classic, The City of God. He writes this book just as the Roman Empire is collapsing around his ears from invasions of barbarians. Augustine was very influenced by Platonic thinking, even though he wasn't all that familiar directly with Plato's works. And he sets the course of Christian thinking for a very long time. In fact, if you're knowledgeable about the history of Christian doctrine or Christian theology, you'll know that Augustine is influential right up to the current moment. Then another 800 years after St. Augustine, a priest around the year 1250 named Thomas Aquinas rediscovers many of the lost works of Aristotle. To put this very briefly, he puts together the thought of Aristotle with the thought of Augustine, comes up with a new synthesis for Christian thinking, and it turns out to be a game changer. The result is, for the most part, what the Roman Catholic Church teaches to this very day. St. Thomas Aquinas is the primary Orthodox theologian of Catholicism. Meanwhile, the Italian poet Dante, who lives one generation after Aquinas, reads Aquinas, is influenced by his work, and as one of the 3 or 4 greatest poets ever to live, presents us with his own view of human nature, fulfillment, and human destiny when he writes his 3 epic poems about hell, purgatory, and heaven. You've probably heard of Dante's Inferno. So now fast forward another 250 years, and we come to about the year 1500, Martin Luther in Germany. Now, Luther gets very angry about a lot of things that are happening in the Catholic Church. He goes back and rips Aquinas apart. He trashes Aristotle. And he returns for his inspiration to the game-changing works of St. Augustine and St. Paul. By doing this, Luther also starts a process that splinters Christianity into a million pieces. Game changers. Another 100 or so years after Luther, we have John Milton. Milton is an English poet. He takes his inspiration from the reforming of Christianity, the Protestant Reformation, and he writes the greatest epic poem in the English language, Paradise Lost. It gives his own picture, the Protestant picture, of human nature, human history, human destiny, God's will. So, if you happen to be a Catholic, and you believe that the Catholic Church teaches the same thing always and everywhere and has from the very beginning, or if you're an evangelical Protestant, and you believe that all of your own views come directly from a plain, straightforward reading of New Testament texts, in either case, you could not be more mistaken. The very teachings of the Catholic Church, or the very ways that a Protestant Christian interprets the words of the Bible and Scripture, results from speculations and collisions taking place among ideas that involve Plato, Aristotle, Augustine, Aquinas, St. Paul, Dante, Martin Luther, and Milton. Here's a very small example of something quite specific. Many Christians believe that Satan, the devil, was once a great archangel. In fact, that he was the highest of all the angels, and that his name was Lucifer, and that he rebelled against God in heaven before the creation of the entire world. Later, he successfully tempted our first parents, Adam and Eve, to eat an apple in the Garden of Eden. There is actually remarkably little in the Hebrew scriptures about Satan. And what's there does not happen to include these beliefs. Satan, as we imagine him, is actually a much later invention. And he's not thought of as either a fallen angel or even fully identified with the serpent in the garden who tempted Adam and Eve to taste the fruit until 4 centuries after the life of Christ. Augustine has a lot to do with who Satan becomes. And the picture that you yourself may have in your mind of a rebel angel, a war in heaven between the good angels and the bad angels, well, that's something that John Milton imagined for us when he published Paradise Lost in 1667. Socrates and Plato and Aristotle exert influences in many other threads or conversations or discussions that are taking place in the Western history of ideas. For instance, the encounter with Socrates enters very strongly into Soren Kierkegaard's work in the 19th century. Kierkegaard's the godfather of existentialism. Ultimately, Kierkegaard produces all these other philosophers like Heidegger and Sartre. Socrates also provoked and gave shape in an encounter, a philosophical encounter, gave shape to Friedrich Nietzsche's thought, also in the 19th century, as Nietzsche actually seeks to try to undo what he considers to be the disaster that Socrates has bequeathed to Western civilization. So you simply cannot study the history of Western thought without running into Plato and Socrates just around about every corner. You can't read a thinker who hasn't been influenced himself or herself by these ideas in some way, as well as the way that they actually pose the original questions. What's the best sort of life for a human being? And what's the best kind of society in which that sort of life can be lived? So the Republic is still what I would call a living book. It still fuels encounters. It still provokes us, students in my classroom, I think just as much as Socrates provoked them in the streets of ancient Greece. It has something to teach us. It has something to connect us very deeply to the ideas of many others. It's something that's made our society, in some very deep respects, what it is. You might say that Plato and his inspiration, Socrates, are the opposite of outdated thinkers. On this quick dash through the centuries, I've not forgotten the question that I'm supposed to answer, which is, so what? Why does it do you any good to know these things? What's all this about strenuous effort? And what's that got to do with something being a classic? Aren't there any classics that are easy to read? Or to cut to the chase, and regarding all of this strenuous effort, why do I really have to dig into Plato's Republic at all? Why can't I just hear about it from you? Or why can't I read the Cliff Notes version? Or why can't I find a summary or a digest or look on my neighbor's notes? Why won't Wikipedia tell me everything that is truly important for me to take away from the book? Why can't I take advantage of the fact that all these other people have read it, commented on it, and used it for some purpose or another? What's the takeaway? Well, the 20th century philosopher and critic Mortimer Adler put it this way: the path of true learning is strewn with rocks, not roses. But I am still saying, he goes on, that the great books can be read by every person. In one sense, of course, they are the most difficult to read, but they are, in another sense, the most readable, both for the less and the more competent reader, because they are the most instructive. What Adler is trying to tell us here is that just because something is difficult doesn't mean that the time you spend with it is not worthwhile. And in fact, that any amount of time that you spend with one of these kinds of works will actually be more valuable to you than the same amount of time that you spend on a work of lesser quality. But what Adler wants us to understand is the principle of no pain, no gain. And in fact, that in the case of works of the mind, that whatever the pain you experience, whatever time and study that you're going to give to these works pay a greater return. You might say they have a higher interest rate than the ordinary stocks and bonds that you're going to be exposed to in the rest of your courses. So what I'm going to do now is to try to give you five takeaways, that is, five valuable things that are specific to you that you can pull out of these books and take away with you to the other things that you're studying and also to your own life. Number one, the value of forgotten ideas. Some old ideas are not actually outdated. The entire period that we call the European Renaissance actually consisted of people rediscovering a bunch of ideas from the ancient world and giving them a new application. So, point number one is, some of these old ideas are actually valuable. Number two, the value of making connections between ideas. There is less new under the sun than what you might think. And seeing the connections that tie one thinker to another in a tradition also gives you a measure of how far we've come on some problems and what problems seem to have heavily resisted the attempts of human beings to give them answers. The one that we've been considering from time to time through the course of this talk is one of those. What's the best sort of life for a human being? This is a question that you'll be asking yourself as you try to figure out things like, where am I going to get a job? Where am I going to live? Who am I going to marry? How am I going to raise my children? These are questions that are permanent aspects of the human condition. You're also going to discover that this is not the kind of question in which science has suddenly delivered a fantastic new answer. People have been asking and answering this question for a long time. And looking at some old thinkers can help you see the connections between the ways people originally asked these questions and the way we do, but also give you a perspective on what's been solved, which in some of these cases is very little, and what remains for you to consider and actually determine by the way that you live your own life. The third thing is that great books of the past are going to engage you with a number of great minds who don't share any of your assumptions, just as we were talking about with Plato. It's a different culture, a different morality, a different religion, a different politics. Call this the value of strangeness, which is not only an additional perspective on what you believe, but I'm going to claim is also a primary source of human creativity. The fourth value is, quite frankly, the value of building up your intellectual muscle power. You don't get to be a better wrestler by wrestling all the little kids in your neighborhood and beating them up and sending them home crying. If you're going to be a better wrestler, you're going to have to get your own nose bloody by going up against people who are bigger and stronger and better than you are. So finally, five, there's the value of forming better judgments. Once you've encountered with the best of all time and wrestled them to the ground, you're going to be much better positioned to make your own good, discerning judgments about where to spend your precious time without having past generations of experts to do the reading, you might say, ahead of you and post the signs, without knowing how a book is going to influence other books, And without yourself being able to figure what the views are going to be of this book in the future, you will be able to tell junk from gold, trash from something that's worthwhile. Why? Because you'll know when you're actually up against a real mind. You will have experienced the best that we know. So let's dig down a little bit into the value of some old and outdated ideas. A man named Malthus in 1798 published a classic work in political economy. It's called An Essay in the Principle of Population. Now, the basic idea is that populations can only grow up to the point where they necessarily collapse because of limited resources, famine, and disease. But the essay explores the ideas in a lot of very interesting ways, and actually it was a major influence on Charles Darwin in the development of the theory of evolution. Despite the game-changing nature of this work, economists and scientists of the industrial age have generally held that Malthus was wrong. Why? Because he predicted we were all going to die back in the 18th century. He thought that we were going to outrun the food sources with our population, and that nothing could stop a headlong rush over the cliff. What he did not take into proper account were the game-changing aspects of human ingenuity and creativity that would find a way around resource bottlenecks. Now, during the oil shocks of the 1970s, and if you go back and look for this, you'll see that the ideas of Malthus came very much back into view. Why? Because people were seeing resources begin to run out. The world's population had doubled over a period of about 30 to 60 years, and it was going to be set to double again. So Thomas Malthus and his ideas about what happens when you increase the population past the carrying load came around for more currency. Today, if you Google the name Malthus, you're going to get over 3 million hits on the internet. His fundamental ideas are once again at the center of debates about peak oil, environmental damage, global population, the prospects for global catastrophe. Malthusian ideas are everywhere, and his work is being invoked as people wonder if the world is about to prove Malthus right in the end. Here's another example of old ideas being mined for new insights. In ancient Greece, Aristotle wrote a book called the Nicomachean Ethics, or for short, The Ethics. It's actually a book about human happiness and about what it takes to be a happy person. Now, we don't ordinarily associate the idea of ethics with a work on happiness. We think about ethics as being things like moral obligations, duties, what we're called upon to perform despite our desires to do other things. Aristotle had a different perspective on this. He was an original proponent of the idea, and you may have heard this idea, that virtue is its own reward. That in fact, the things that make you an excellent parent, the things that make you an excellent citizen, are also the things, if pursued consciously and done well, make you a happy human being. In other words, that there's a dedication to excellence, where excellence consists of the virtues that are required for us to live well and do well with one another, that is the foundation for human beings to be happy. This goes these days by the name virtue ethics. And philosophers and psychologists all over the world are studying what makes for human happiness. Aristotle actually has something extremely contemporary to contribute to that debate. So again, reading these works gives you a very different sense of what progress consists of in one whole area of human thought, and what even our notion of progress might mean when we start to talk about something like human happiness. Are there really new messages coming from the cosmos about what it takes to be happy? My third value or takeaway involved what I call the value of strangeness. Now, this one's a little harder to explain, so let me use an analogy. You've probably traveled. People like to travel. Some people travel a great deal. What do people feel like they learn from traveling, particularly travel to another society? One of the things that good travelers, people who have done this well and spent enough time in a foreign society to really learn something about it, they generally say that they're struck by the ways that that society is different from our own, and they're struck by the different kinds of answers that people give to questions that we suddenly discover we've made a lot of assumptions about. That is, we've made an assumption about our lifestyle, or an assumption about what people want out of life, or an assumption about how people are going to get those things that actually isn't operating in this other society at all. And of course, it might make us stop and think, is our way of doing this actually the best way of doing it? Might I pick up some ideas from this other place? Well, great books can have some of this same effect through the value of strangeness. Let's consider two women writers for a moment. And if you've been paying attention, you might have noticed that I haven't talked about any women thinkers or writers up to this point. And in that regard, it's important to remember that until very recent times, very few women had access to the kinds of educations or were given the kind of encouragement to engage in this kind of thinking or this kind of work or this kind of reading as they are today. So you might say it's only very recently that women have entered this long conversation. Why? Because they were excluded from it. But Jane Austen was a brilliant novelist, and what Jane Austen wrote about were the manners and the ways of life and the marriage and family arrangements of English country gentry of the late 1700s. Now, it's very unlikely that you're going to have much knowledge about the ways of life that were current among the English gentry in the late 1700s. And that is just what makes encountering them valuable and what makes encountering Jane Austen herself valuable. For she knows this world and these people inside and out. And she's an exceptional, clever, and devastating observer of the human heart. You come to know both the world that these people occupied and the ways in which they occupied this world in a way that no other author is ever going to reveal. Or take another example, Emily Dickinson. Now, Emily Dickinson was one of the two or three master poets that the United States has produced. She had an even more narrow and an even stranger world to show us, consisting primarily of the workings of her own mind and her emotions, which were exceptionally focused and intense. It was Dickinson, a virtual recluse, who said, "Parting is all we know of heaven and is all we need of hell." She also said, "One need not be a chamber to be haunted." And also this, "An ear can break a human heart as quickly as a spear. We wish the ear had not a heart so dangerously near." Reading Emily Dickinson will introduce you to a mind and a heart that simply does not work like yours. It doesn't work like mine, but she knows yours, and she knows her own as well. Thoughts, like Dickinson's and like Austen's, can dislodge us from the everyday world, the things that we're familiar with, and the ways that we tend to find it natural to think. But isn't that the value of an education? And isn't one of the most practical things that the world is seeking, the world of business, the world of law, the world of government, the world of the arts, even the world of academia, aren't they seeking for people who take up new and strange and different and creative perspectives? In other words, isn't this takeaway from these great and classic works maybe among the most practical things that they have to offer us? Thank you. My fourth value involved building your muscles and your reading skills and the ways that you're going to tackle increasingly difficult material. Now, I don't think this one requires illustration so much as it does a reminder. As we said, you don't get to the Olympics by training with weaklings. And these works have survived in part because they've been written by geniuses. That is, we know that these are minds worth wrestling with because so many have. The good news is that does not mean that you have to be a genius to understand them. Thank God, or I wouldn't have made it very far myself. You have heard the saying, she got to where she is by standing on the shoulders of giants. So here are the giants. Master the skills that it takes to get up on their shoulders, and you're going to see quite a distance. You'll see more than they saw. You'll also be prepared, better prepared, to grapple with lesser works that don't stand as tall. So for the fifth value, I said that to the extent that you encounter and engage classic works successfully, you'd be a better judge of modern works. And my example here has to be Shakespeare. Now, many of the greatest critics and readers of world literature, including across cultures and across boundaries, have had the same basic view of Shakespeare. And that is, whatever his flaws, whatever the weaknesses, and whatever the strengths of other writers, no literary giant has ever written more profoundly or more inventively or more imaginatively about the human condition than Shakespeare. Harold Bloom, the great literary critic where I work and teach here at Yale, called one of his books on Shakespeare The Invention of the Human. And he meant by this that Shakespeare, with these characters like Falstaff and Hamlet and King Lear, quite literally created, around the year 1600, our modern sense of what it means to be a human being acting and thinking in the world. Many of his hundreds of memorable characters, men and women, either vividly or unexpectedly respond to their life situations in ways that we couldn't predict or typecast, or they open up new perspectives on what truly motivates each of us. So, once you have successfully engaged Shakespeare in his comedies and in his tragedies, you're going to very quickly sense in other writers whether or not they're capable of doing the same thing. And if they are, you're going to be drawn on to read them. And if they're not, you can safely set them aside because you've got a better standard against which to make your choices. Let's say that you're persuaded of these five valuable things that I say you can take away from these work if you include some of them on your course schedule in college. Could your life be better, personally, if you invited some of these authors into it? And how so? So think about it like this. I shared an experience a number of years ago when my son got involved, and I got involved as well, in the Boy Scouts. We hiked, we camped, we made friends. We had lots of families in the troop, lots of other adults on the trips. It was all fine. It was wonderful. But then we came to a point in the development of these young men and their skills where we were prepared to introduce them to something more adventurous. And we planned a 2-week wilderness expedition, something that we hadn't come close to doing with these young men before. I was very excited. It was something that I had done, and I wanted my son to have the same experience as I had had. "So let me get this straight," he said. "We'll have to carry twice the weight on our backs that we ever have before, including the food. The food's going to be pretty bad. We're going to have to purify every single drop of water we drink. We'll have to figure out our own trail. It's going to be in rugged mountains. We'll probably spend some time getting lost. What exactly am I going to get out of this that I can't get from the hiking and camping that we've already done, which I've liked perfectly fine, and which we did without all this pain and hassle?" Smart boy, good questions. So I finally said, you know, I don't think I can really tell you what you're going to get out of this. You have to experience it for yourself, and then you'll know. So I guess I'm just asking you to trust me on this. So my son Paul certainly had some skeptical company among the other scouts in the troop. And sure enough, a few days into this expedition, things began to deteriorate. We had some lousy weather, there's blisters, people are hungry, the boys are ragging on each other, no one's really getting along. My son is looking at me with those all-knowing eyes of a 16-year-old. But then, the boys started to toughen up, the weather cleared, we got higher up in the mountains, they started to rely on each other more, they figured out how to break camp efficiently, and so one day, we get to a really terrific climb, during which there was a fair amount of complaining. It was a brutal effort. And when we emerged from the tree line, we're on top of the highest peak in the region. We were exhilarated. The boys were exhilarated. And my son came over to me and he said, "Hey, Dad." I said, "What?" He said, "This is fantastic." I said, "I know." And he said, "I just want you to know I get it." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "This is by far the most fantastic thing that we've ever done together." So what had we learned by virtue of taking a much more arduous, a much more difficult journey than we had taken up to that point in our scouting experience? Well, he's now got an experience of the outdoors that's given him a permanent interest that he can pursue in life. And of course, there was also the element of the experience that revolved around the connection that he and I made together by virtue of having the experience together. So remember what Adler said. In one sense, of course, the great books are the most difficult to read, but they are, in another sense, the most readable, both for the less and the more competent, because they are the most instructive. And that's the key word. Obviously, I do not mean, says Adler, most readable in the sense of with the least effort, even for the expert. I mean that these books reward every degree of effort and ability to the maximum. So here's something else to think about, and it's something that Adler has to say, and it goes beyond the five takeaways that I gave you for things of value that you can derive from these books. You're going to encounter a lot of things in your life that you need to know and things that you need to learn about that aren't going to change you much at all. You've learned many of these things already. You learned how to drive a car, but that didn't change who you were as a human being. I'm suggesting to you now that you're going to be in the same position with relation to these works we've been talking about in this lecture as the scout who's done the weekend hiking, taken the day trip, maybe cooked breakfast at the campery, and so forth. Remember how I said at the beginning that Aristotle said it's our nature to want to know things. Well, just as it's our nature to work, to play, to find a mate, to live in society, remember how I said that wisdom is something different from knowledge. Well, here's my final thought for you, and it's a deep paradox of learning. You don't necessarily know what you are looking for until you find it. And it's the effort of finding it that actually turns you into a different person than the one who set out on the journey to begin with. And that's why reading these great works is very similar, in fact, to the experience that my son had of a wilderness expedition after never having attempted anything more than what you can get on the low-lying ground. So when you finally do achieve a radical new perspective, when it's not just a matter of taking in bits of information and knowledge, but it's a matter of changing how you put them together, and also it's a matter of changing who you are as a result, you will see a different value in these things, in, for instance, these books, and you're also going to see yourself in a new light. So I give you the only answer that I really can, the best answer I know. Why read these books? It's the same answer I gave my son. You climb up into the mountains, you make your most strenuous effort, you give it everything you have, and what's your reward? It's the view. It's the view. Thank you very much.
Okay, we're going to be going to an open forum in a few minutes. First, I want to just make a few points here about what we just heard. And Jan, I don't know if we have any questions, and unless you think the questions are important, we'll skip the questions until through email, that is, until next week. Do we have any important announcements to make?
No, there's two questions, and one of them's about Berry County Sheriff and so on, and they could wait till next week, I guess.
Okay, that's what we'll do. All right, because I want to try to get as much time as in as we can. All right, the purpose of National Liberty Alliance is to provide a venue for a proper education, and a proper education as defined and spoken about by Thomas Jefferson, and also to bring communications between the people, so and offer a place for communications and organization as we build committees of safety on a county level. And that's what we're pursuing right now. I was looking into the record of what we've got. I think we've got 121 committees of safety started already. I don't know to what degree they're at, but we're working on that, communicating with these people in order to discover, where they are as they're moving forward. And one of the things we're teaching the people who are building committees of safety, which is the only way we can have government by consent. It's the only way we can take back our nation. It's people must get involved on the grassroots level. They must become properly educated. They must have a proper view. And the view that we're looking at is the view to find the science of government by consent. I could say that, most of these books, of course, I haven't read myself either. I've gotten bits and pieces. I've read parts of some of these books here and there over the years. But finding time on considering the other things I have to learn from my career and now also in my research and the running of National Liberty Alliance, my focus has been all on common law, at least the last 13 years. I've been exploring and researching common law and our founding fathers, how we became a nation, who we are as a people, what is our heritage, what is law. And that is the key, the most important thing. These great books, you read through them, and it's the big conversations and a lot of answers they didn't have, and they people have gotten as time went on. And remember, the Bible was the first book, because the Bible was long before Aristotle. We have the Old Testament, the first five books of the Bible, and then, of course, over the years, we have a lot of the prophetic books and other books, the historical books within the Bible. So really, that is the very first. And the Bible is considered part of the great books. I had purchased the great books many years ago. The Bible is one of those books. Now, they didn't include the Bible, but they made the note that there was a space, and this is where the Bible is part of the great conversation. And so really, everything really comes forward. The subject matter, the questions, the concern, justice, God, the human spirit, the heart, the soul, virtue. These are the things, nature, ethics, the law, and the necessity of a king. Common law had always required a king. The king was the sovereign, and he maintained the sovereign of the sovereignty of the free man. And so when you had a problem or a situation, you'd try to find out where the king was and chase him down, and when he had his court, you'd go in there to get your justice in order to have the justice that you're chasing and believe that you deserve as a sovereign individual. Nothing has changed in the sense of our courts either. We have a problem. We expect to be able to go to our courts and have these problems dealt with. courts are, we've been robbed of our courts. They've stolen it from us. They've turned it from natural law into civil law. But we, you know, the way our founding fathers, you know, gave us this system that we have, we were to find justice in the courts. And the justice and the king of the court is ultimately God. Remember, the jury is the king's bench. They're to reflect the image of God. They're to reflect that which is just and right and good. They're to reflect the virtue and get to the conclusion of the matter in order to mete out justice. And so we do need a king. Of course, the conclusion of the great conversations took us away from the king, and we don't have a king, but we do have a king. And the kings the way the world worked up until, 1776, when our founders wrote the Declaration of Independence, particularly Thomas Jefferson, and we became a nation in 1789. The Constitution came into effect, and a couple of years later, they added to it the Bill of Rights, which was agreed upon when the Constitution was agreed upon that these rights would be added, and so they had some more discussion. And these discussions are found in the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers, and both of which are important, okay, because it gives you the view of who we are as a people, how we became what we are, the heritage. I mean, we have totally lost our way. For 13 years or 14 years, and actually more than that, but for 14 years, I have been focused in on our founding fathers, focused in on common law, trying to understand it. I mean, I had started before that, but very confused and didn't have a real, you know, trying to listen to people and trying to figure out what was going on. And a lot of people really didn't give a lot of proof to what they were claiming, but it sounded good. And as time goes on, some of it was, not necessarily so good. The man on the land stuff, a lot of people teaching a lot of that stuff. It's good stuff to some degree. There's truth to it, but there's a lot of problems with it also. And until you start to do the research to find out who we are as a people, to find our heritage and what it is that we expect, okay, that's where we need to begin. And I could tell you, I've been, by the mercy of God, been blessed to be a Bible student for 40 years, maybe 50 years. I've got to think about that, how long it's been. Probably 50, almost 50 years, 45 years, let's say. So I have been a Bible student. I've been studying the Bible for many, many years. So I had the proper base, the proper foundation to come to an understanding and appreciation of common law by the time I came to understand what common law was. And so my suggestion to people, if you don't read any of these books, read the Bible, because everything that they're talking about, everything that they're debating or bringing to point and disagreeing with or agreeing with, all these subject matters ultimately come from the Bible, every single one of them. And I'll just repeat them again: justice, God, the human spirit, the heart, the soul, virtue, nature, ethics. Leviathan. I never read the book Leviathan, but I heard about Leviathan in the Bible, and I came to understand that Leviathan ultimately is a picture of the world government. That's what it is. It's ultimately the Satan, the kingdom of Satan, ruling the world. He's the prince and power of the world. That's where Leviathan is. The New World Order is the power and the authority, the place you'd find. It is Leviathan, the sea monster, the sea being a picture of the world, and sinking down into the sea, sinking down into the depths of hell, to be in a ship and a boat to go to the other side is a picture of coming into the body of Christ or the true church of God, and at the end of your life getting to heaven when you get to the other side of the sea. There's many, many pictures in the Bible. The whole Bible is a book of parables. They're historical facts, absolutely. Historical books, the four Gospels are historical books. But every word that Jesus spoke, for instance, without a parable, spake he not, the Bible tells us. So everything he said had a hidden meaning. Everything he'd done, every action in the Bible, of all of the players of the Bible, going all the way back to Genesis and right through Revelations, it brings us to a picture, spiritual pictures, parables, insights, understanding, ultimately wisdom. So my suggestion to people is that's the basis. That's the place where we learn to how to navigate life. That's the place where we find an anchor so we don't drift away. I would strongly, because I see a lot of people who are highly educated and never read the Bible, but they've read a lot of these great works, and they're out there. They're lost in many ways, and, they don't have a really good, strong picture of ultimately God and eternity. And so a lot of people get lost out there. So you need that anchor. And I do believe, that's why our founding fathers, and again, I mentioned this earlier, up until the 20th century, the foundation of our education was the Bible. You learned to read from the Bible. And you had your literature and understanding, your morals, your virtues. We were taught from the Bible. They took that out of our schools, as well as they took God out of our, not only our schools, but they took God out of our courts. You know, in 1934, the Rules Enabling Act, they destroyed everything. And they turned everything upside down so that by 1938, when the rules came into play, the rules, they removed the rules of common law and replaced it with the laws of men, the rules of men. They removed the law and replaced it with statutes and codes. Not that they don't have any purpose, because they absolutely do. There are 57 codes. They all have a purpose. But unfortunately, they added into those codes, particularly in USC 18 and USC 28, they added into these codes things to control us, we the people, and to imprison us. So they got rid of common law. So there is no justice in our courts. They're all paid off. They maintain status quo. They uphold that which is the status quo. And so, you know, again, the purpose of National Liberty Alliance is to bring a different view, to bring the view that our founding fathers gave us. And again, just real quickly, and we're going to go into Q&A in a minute, you know, I sent a message out to everybody, and a lot of people have joined us with us, and we're about ready to move on those joiners. It's going to take a couple of months to put things together, but our timing, I think, will be right. You know, we've got to hit things on the right timing, and with the things going on the way they're going on, things are about ready to break. And but let's look at real quick at the education that we offer here. And one of the things we brought up to those people who came in to join us, and I don't know if they've kept their word on this, but I hope that they have, or maybe they're continuing to work on it a little at a time, and that's fine, and that is to become educated. They agreed when they came in as joined us to add their case in that they would become educated by taking our free courses. You don't have to take, we only have one paid course, and it's only $5 a month donation, you know, the free courses, so they understand and get an understanding of what we're doing, because they need to understand what we're doing. We the people need to be able to represent and take care of our own business in the courts as we do in the rest of our lives. So we required that education, and I certainly hope that they, you know, fulfill that part. But we have a duty when we come to an understanding that this nation is in trouble. We're about ready to lose everything. But by the grace of God, for the few things that are going on that's going to bring us through this thing, you know, we're very close to have lose everything. And we have a duty to step up and take care of business. You know, Trump is doing what he's got to do, and things are about to break. Devolution, I'm sure most of us know about devolution, maybe those who haven't been coming to our Monday night meetings and following along may not be totally aware, they think it's crazy or whatever, but anybody paying attention knows it's absolutely true, because truth is consistent. Truth is self-evident, and over time it reveals itself, or the lie is revealed. The truth is revealed, the fact that it's a lie. We have a duty when we come to an understanding and an appreciation and find a place to get educated in order to save this great nation. We are a republic. We're not a democracy. I listen to people talk that are in power and authority, whether these U.S. Supreme Court justices or any of the political animals out there, whether in Congress or the Senate, whether they're local government. I mean, they're totally ignorant to the Constitution. They're totally ignorant to the fact that we are a republic. They're totally ignorant to the fact that we've lost our courts of justice. There is no justice in our courts. Once in a while, you can get it, as long as you're not going up against the establishment. Little squabbles where they really don't care who wins. Maybe they'll give you the bone to the right person, you know. But these people are all lost. And a house needs to be cleaned, and we the people need to step up, become mature enough to take control of who we are as a people. We need to take control in order to have our heritage. You know, if we don't understand and have a good insight on government by consent, if we don't understand that and know the science of government by consent, then we cannot truly know our heritage, and we cannot never, ever, ever have government by consent, and liberty will be lost forever. Liberty is not possible. Our heritage, liberty is our heritage. That's what we inherit, is the liberty, what our founding fathers paid for. And they paid dearly, many with their lives. But anyway, we're here to offer a proper education, as Jefferson spoke about, communications between the people on the grassroots level without interfering with their business, and organizing organization and building organizations on the grassroots level where the people take care of that business. One of the things we will be going forward with, as I mentioned, is these joinders. Again, it's going to take a little time to put the paperwork together, but people who have these joinders, and they need to get involved, they need to get educated, and they need to give back. Everything we do here at National Liberty Alliance is freely given, totally free, okay? And we ask for donations, we survive with donations, but it is freely given. And so freely have you received, and it is now your duty to freely give back, not to us particularly, but to the next person who needs help, who needs a situation, by stepping up and taking control and bringing our government back under the chains of the Constitution. But anyway, getting back, before we open up to the forum here, and anybody wants to get into the queue, it's a *6 and a 1 if you're coming in on a regular phone. If you're coming in on a smartphone with an app, or coming through your computer with an app, or even through your browser, you'll find a button there to get into the queue. But on a phone, it's *6, and then you'll be told to click a 1, and you'll come into the queue. But the education, and I just want to quickly go through this. If you come into our website, nationallibertyalliance.org, and you highlight the tab here, Education Starts Here, that's where you'll find the courses. But you'll find American history. We have American history lectures. We have Christianity in America. The Federalist Papers. We have the Federalist Papers. You can download. You can read it online. It's in PDF form. And we also have, right next to it, we have the audios. Let me just click on the Federalist for right now to see. I think we gave a listing of a breakdown to be able to get around the Federalist Papers. But if not, I will get that up here because we do have that. I know I put it into my book. Federalist Papers Index. Okay, here it is. Here's a Federalist Papers Index. Through here it will help you to find certain subject matter that you're looking to try to come to an understanding of, and the different arguments and debates that took place, and the final results of that, the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers. Ultimately, the final results was the Constitution. And it was the Anti-Federalist Papers that really pushed forward to make sure that a Bill of Rights was put in place. And in 1789, when our founding fathers finally finished the debate and had that paper ready to go, ready to create a more perfect union, because at the time it was not as good a union as they would hope for, but it became a more perfect union. And I do believe that our Constitution is sufficient enough to give us that perfect union. I hear people that want to do a con. They want to go in and play and tinker around with the Constitution. Hey, why don't we first start exercising it and see how things might work out once we start using it, and then see if it's missing something that we need to add to it. Because from my perspective, from my view, we don't need anything added to it. Everything we need is right there. That's my view. And that's the fruits of my work of 14 years of research in the subject matter, and many, many years before that. As I mentioned, and I'm a student of the Bible, and still am for many, many years. But these two things particularly, the founding documents, the Federalist Papers, which includes also the Anti-Federalist Papers, which was the movement really that pushed forward the Bill of Rights to make sure, and had a lot of influence on what took place in the Federalist arguments and debates also, to make sure, particularly Madison was the one that pressed this forward, and Madison and Jefferson worked together in order to accomplish this. But they made sure that we ended up with a small federal government where the states, most of the powers and the authorities were left in the with the people in the states. We look around and it's not the way it is today. We need to return back to our roots. But people don't know that. They don't understand that. They don't know what the difference between a Republican and a Democrat. You know, a Democrat is really, well, I'm not going to get into that discussion now, but we can. We've discussed it in the past and we can discuss it again. People want to know more about that, the difference between the two and the history and how they came about being. But again, I say very strongly, and I suggest very strongly, start with the Bible and then start working with the studies that we have, you know, our education, American history. Real quick, we got the founding papers here, the documents. We got biographies. We have autobiographies in there, too. Continental Congress 2009, if you're not familiar with that, you should look into that. That was a very powerful. The Continental Congress Act. How many people know that the Continental Congress actually met again in 2009? You know, it was the Continental Congress that brought us into the Revolution and through the Revolution. It's the Continental Congress that brought us the Constitution and the United States of America. And all of this was only possible because of committees of safety, which is what our founding fathers used in order to create this nation. And committees of safety is a process of where people take control of their own needs in a local government, okay? Ultimately, it should be taking care of this, but ultimately, we take care of our own needs. We watch our government, make sure they're doing the right thing. And we make sure we provide for the things that they are not providing for, or if there's no government at all, like when pilgrims came over and they, you know, settled and there was no government. There was committees of safety. They'd gone by different names through history, but generally, mostly, usually, they were called committees of safety. And that's what we're building, rebuilding back. The committeemen were supposed to be committees of safety. But they've been taken over also. They've been statutorized and controlled by, you know, ultimately lawyers, bar attorneys through, you know, the party bosses. And the whole system is set up through a statutory process. I'm not going to go through too much more of this, but we have articles and essays. We have educational videos, the law, the memorandums of law, law dictionaries, court forms and process, different things, state constitutions, introduction to the Constitution. We have government by consent. We have free PDF books, lots of PDF books. What was the one? I think it was, I think this is it, the free PDF books. If you go through here, you'll find a lot of the books that we just heard about in this lecture that we just listened to. Okay, we have a lot of these books right here. We have Locke, we have Hume, we have many, many people. We've got Blackstone. Blackstone is extremely important if you really want to get into it. Once you get through the founding documents, the Federalist Papers, as you're constantly using the Bible, a strong opinion that I'm offering here, but you want to go further, that's where you go, Blackstone, right there, Volume 1 and Volume 2. But anyway, Adam Smith, you know, there's a lot of things there, but again, you know, we need to focus in on what our needs are today. And that is to educate ourselves so that we can have government by consent, so that we can save this republic. And even with devolution in play, and again, anybody who doesn't know about devolution, we do have a page on devolution here. Looking, I think it's under today's issues. Yes, second one down, third one down under today's issue, we have devolution. And so we have a lot of information here. We've got a lot of videos, and people should go through that and all these things on our website to educate themselves and prepare themselves. But I will tell you one thing. The military may be able to, you know, Trump working with the military, because he has set forth revolution that Kennedy originally spoke about and put in play way back when in the 63, and then executed by Donald Trump in 2018, I believe it was, and has been in play ever since, and the military is about ready to come forward to save our republic. And once that happens, and it will be this year, there's no doubt about it, absolutely sure of that at this point. I never would state a date before, but there's no doubt about it at this moment in time. But the military can save the republic, and they can give it back to us. But if the people do not know, they don't understand the science of government by consent, if they don't understand their heritage, if they don't know the Constitution, how can you even tell if they're being obedient to the Constitution if you don't know it? How can you know that if they're violating your rights if you don't know it? A lot of people believe you have to have a driver's license. Oh, no, you got to have a driver's license, you know. No, you don't have to have a driver's license. Okay, so people think certain things that you have to have, and if you don't have a driver's license, they can pull you over and even arrest you. I mean, that's an unbelievable thing, but they can arrest you for that. I know people who've gone to jail for not having a driver's license. So if we don't know the law, if we don't know our law, common law, our Constitution, which is a common law document, if we don't know those things, then we cannot have liberty. You will not have your heritage. Your children will be slaved even worse than you are, because we're only going to return back to where we're just coming from, unless the people step up, because the people who have to fill the void, there's going to be a power void. Remember, they have been in control all of our lives. They've been in control going back over 150 years. And the Constitution, it's the Bill of Rights particularly that has saved us, you know, that mindset, the American mindset of being liberty, being free, you know, that has saved us. But we're very close to losing that. But we have to save these things, and we have to keep them, and if we don't, we're going to lose them. The Constitution, the Bill of Rights being part of that Constitution, the Declaration of Independence being the foundation of that Constitution, the foundation of our law, common law, laid out in the Declaration of Independence, okay, we must save that. It's not going to save itself. It's not going to defend itself. It's you have to defend it. That's the cost of liberty. And we don't have to save it with blood, as our founding fathers did to create, to bring this to us, to offer this to us, to create it for us. They gave their lives, their fortunes, literally gave them up for the purpose of liberty for their posterity. And we are their posterity. And we need to step up and do something. So everybody needs to get involved. Everybody. Okay. All right. I guess I'm just going to end that there for right now. We're going to move into an open forum. I don't know if Brent is here tonight, but if he is, we're going to pass by him tonight so that we can. We've got a lot of people in the queue. Wait, I just hit the wrong button. Did it go? No, it didn't. Okay. Let me get into the queue. I guess it didn't hit. Okay, we're going to take our first question here. Let's see. First person is Bill from Colorado. You got the mic.
Can you hear this?
We can hear you, Bill. Go right ahead.
Oh, well, I got that last email about getting off our duff. I didn't realize that I had passed all the, everything I needed to be get into the jury administrator. And so I thought I better get on here and give it a listen tonight. That's kind of a long story.
Yeah, anybody that wants to be a jury administrator, you know, we wrote a book, and we got another book coming up on a handbook for the jury administrator. That'll be coming up soon. But we do have a book on the grand jury. We have a book on the pettigrew. You can find that under Start a Committee of Safety, and you come to the handbooks and tools. If I don't know if you're viewing the video at the same time as we're talking. Looks like you're on a computer.
I downloaded all that one that you published in the past year, and I think you put some new stuff out there.
Everything has been updated.
I was not aware. I'm 100% through with the education on it, and I'd just like maybe somebody to contact me, or I could contact somebody to kind of get me started.
That is the importance of coming to our Monday night meeting. And if you can't make it, we do record these meetings and to be listening to the latest things that are coming up. The key thing is an education, and if you can spare some time to volunteer with us to work on a national level in order to push forward all of the agendas that we're pushing forward, You know, give us a little time. But you know, I don't know. We do have. I don't know if you've taken the most recent course. If you come to the courses, we have a jury administration accredited course. Have you taken that one yet? That one, I think, was only put up about a year ago. And
I believe I have.
Okay, well, just check, you know, go into your, let's see, what would you call it here, your account, and you should be able to find out what courses you've taken or not get taken. Or you can go into the courses and click on it to start it, and you'll see that you've already taken it. But, you know, if you're going to be an administrator for the jury, which is a very important job, which is a paid position for those who don't know, it's a full-time job, it's a career. We need to take away, when we bring back our courts of justice and get rid of the civil law courts, which is coming up very soon, by the way, when that happens, there's going to be a great power vacuum there. Right now, bar attorneys and bar judges, they control that whole process. We need to take it away from them. They've only proven that they cannot be honest and just and operate these things on behalf of the people. And more than that, our intention is to focus in on the bar. We do need attorneys. We need people who are educated in the codes. There are 57 codes, as I mentioned earlier, and each one of those codes have an application. And they have an application. It controls the government agencies, ultimately, and the agents of those government agencies. For instance, Congress, a code for Congress that controls Congress that was written. There's a code for the Senate, I guess the Senate and the Congress both together. There's one for the president, the administration. There's a code for everything. And those are important, and we need people who are educated in that. But bar attorneys, bar comes, the whole process is really, the purpose of the bar, and they've done a very good job at this, by the way. The purpose of the bar is to destroy our court system. That was their purpose. They were established in the colonies back in 1750 in response to the movement that Benjamin Franklin had a lot to do with his newspaper against the king, because, we eventually went into a revolution over all that. But because the king couldn't control the people, because they were being controlled by the courts and they were far away, so they created the bar system and established it here in the colonies in 1750, and eventually became the American Bar Association in the early 20th century. They still have the same focus, and that is destruction of the common law, destruction of our economic system. The bar is the minions of the New World Order, ultimately. But again, we do need these people who are lawyers, and a lot of them that have studied these laws and are working in the proper areas, they should be able to bone up real quick into the common law and still execute the process that's necessary through statutory processes, the code, the U.S. codes and regulations and so on. So all of that is important. Yep.
So when you say lawyers, are you talking about bar lawyers or
talking about bar lawyers, B-A-R. Yes, I'm talking about them. They are problematic.
And so you need some of them, but you don't have to be a bar lawyer.
Absolutely not. Look at from their perspective. Oh no, not no. From their perspective,
okay.
In the courts, though. From their perspective in the courts, you can't come into their courts unless you have their license. And their license is really sort of like a card that they give to people. The government doesn't give them any license. The government does give a special license to lawyers who represent people who are, children, people who are incapable of representing themselves altogether and they have no one else to represent them. They can represent those individuals, and those lawyers are licensed by the state. But other than that, there is no real license. But they think, or their process and thinking is, you can't come into our civil law courts. I know when I go into a court, we open up a court of record, and I'm not in your civil law court. It has nothing to do with me. Besides that, there's a federal code that talks about the next friend. I have the ability to walk into a court, and the law, their equity law has already said so, that I can come in, not only represent myself, but represent a group of people. So everything they do, of course, and talk about, they don't even obey their own rules. But, yeah, look, if you're involved in becoming a jury administrator, you really need to be connected with NLA. I thought we were clear with that when
I
we.
I have been for years. I've been paying $5. I've taken the classes. I don't know.
Well, that's the key. Then you're
from here. I'd like to work with somebody and get going on it.
Well, right now we're building committees of safety. We're preparing. We've already initiated a couple of years ago a case against the judiciary. They've been moving that forward for years. We've attached a lot of joinder cases to our case against the judiciary, and when someone brings that up, we'll talk a little bit about what we're doing with that, and because we're ready to move forward, but we have a lot of paperwork to put together in order to do the filing, and we're looking for help on that paperwork, and we're looking for help for a lot of things, so people that can volunteer a little time. We're not asking for a lot of time, a couple hours a week or a couple hours a month, to assist us in the work, because people are not paid here. This is all voluntary. And at some point, National Liberty Alliance will have people who are employed and getting a paycheck, but we don't have those kind of fundings yet. But we will have that once we establish enough organization across the nation and start to get some funding in from various sources. Remember, the courts have to, each of the counties have to pour in a certain amount of money in order to maintain the process of even just the jury administrators, and also a presence of a website. That will be a big thing for us and start to bring in a great deal of income in order to pay people to do the job that we're doing voluntarily at this point. So the people who are volunteering now, let me make this point. The people who are volunteering now with their time, they will have the first option if they want to make a career with National Liberty Alliance and work 40 hours a week.
Okay.
They will
so
have,
who do I make contact with to get on? I have some time that I can do some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Who would I contact to schedule what I feel like maybe I could do?
Get a hold of send an email to Jan, J-A-N, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Give him your name, your phone number. Okay, give him your name and your phone number, and tell him what it is that you're interested to do. Matter of fact, if you go to our page, we put this under Start a Committee of Safety down on the bottom. We have a district coordinator's page, and this explains, really our duties and we're looking for help, people to join us. But it lays out the duties, the coordinator's duties, which is really everybody, the different positions that we need to fill. And there's more that we haven't even thought about that needs to be filled. What our goals are, all the leadership must be involved with, what they must be doing, the district coordinator's duties, and so on. So it's free to this page, and this page will be updated soon. We are trying to really organize a lot better working with the district coordinators. The district coordinator's job is really to really make communications and assist the people on the grassroots level to create their committees of safety in order to take back this great nation of ours.
All right.
John, also, Bill, you can call me. This is Terry. My number's all over the web page there. And I'll try and call you in the next day or two. Maybe
you want.
No, we see your number.
Do you have my number?
Oh, no, wait a minute. No, we don't. I think you're not coming in on a phone. Yeah, you are. You're coming in through a phone. Yeah.
I am, but it's probably not under my name. It's probably Tasia Tyler, maybe.
No, we got Bill from Colorado.
Okay, good.
We may have put your phone number at an earlier time.
I'll give you my phone number right now.
No, we got it. It's 3160, right?
Let me give you a call.
Terry will give you a call.
I appreciate that.
And then we'll talk about, they'll talk with you ultimately about what you really want to try to do to assist us and how much time you have. And then we'll start working that out. We'll be having a big meeting for those people who are involved in probably about 2 weeks, I hope. Right now I'm working with building a leadership in order to control that. So we have a couple of people who are going to be handling that and to organize that, all that work. So, all right, we're going to take our next call, Bill. Thanks for the question.
Okay, all right. Just could I find out, when do I expect a call from the man that said he'd call me?
Well, that was Terry. She'll call you probably tomorrow or the next day, right, Terry?
Yes.
Okay.
I've got to watch grandkids tomorrow morning, so it'll probably be tomorrow afternoon or
yeah, you guys will connect.
Okay, tomorrow afternoon would be better. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll look forward to it.
Okay, let's take next caller. Thank you. Next caller is Kurt. You got Mike. Go right ahead, Kurt. Kurt, you're up there with a Hotmail. Final call for Kurt. I don't know if you're muted. Maybe you can't talk when you have to unmute yourself on your computer. Call once, twice, three times. Okay, we'll go to our next question. Jamie, you got the mic. Oh, no, is it Jamie? No. 252, you got the mic. Area code.
Yes, hello.
Yes, go right ahead. Yes.
Hello. My name is Maynard, and I'm in North Carolina. I got pulled over last weekend. Apparently, my tags expired because my.
Right, well, if you wanna come on next weekend to talk about next Monday to talk about that, we will. But right now, we want to focus in on what we're talking about tonight, and we may be talking. Well, I'm hoping to be talking a little bit about joinders when someone brings that issue up. But do you have anything? You have anything on these? And by the way, for those who don't know, I've written a couple of books. You can find them under the educational tab, and you can come down towards the end. You'll see books by John Duresh. And when you open it up, I wrote two books. They're pretty big books. One's Government by Consent. It's an in-depth book. And the other one is Court Access and the Common Law. And that's an extremely, anybody that wants to take care of their business in the courts, which everyone should, no one should rely on a lawyer. You should be able to take your own business, write your own papers. This book will teach you all those things. Lays out the anatomy of a court case, all the necessary papers to file in, how the motions work, how the process works, how the trial works, how to write some papers. It gives you a lot of information, some insights, some mindsets on paperwork. Lots of memorandums and different things. So that's a good book that you should consider purchasing. You can get information here. It's only $39.95 for that book. I tried to make, and it's a big book, so it's power-packed. I mean, my publisher, that was self-published. My publisher, with another book equal to that in size and content, let's say, they're selling it for $45. But I did a hardcover. And I put that up on Amazon, so I'm selling it for $39 and change. So you can get both of those books if you want. And there's lots of handbooks. I mean, the handbooks are all free. You can find them as PDFs underneath Start a Committee of Safety, and you come down to Handbooks and Tools. You'll find these handbooks there in a PDF form. But if you want a handbook, a pocket handbook, which is printed out and you can put it in your shirt pocket or your back pocket, all of those handbooks are available here. And there's a couple more I want to put up here, but I got the County Committee of Safety Committeeman Handbook, which is how to create a Committee of Safety. Got the Committee of Safety Common Law Handbook. We have Founding Documents of the United States, County Sheriff's Book, Common Law Petit Jury, a Common Law Handbook for the Grand Jury, and we've got a Common Law Court Handbook. And there's another book that I'm trying to get through right now, which works with the Common Law Court Handbook, which is a lot of memorandums. So those are two little books to have when you're in courts. But to understand the process, work through the system, the strategy of dealing with the commercial activity as far as driving is concerned, that is covered in Court Access and the Common Law. It gives you a good way to deal with
question.
It. And we can, next week if you bring that up, I'll get into more detail of the strategy in traffic court. Because we have a powerful plan on how to deal with that strategy.
I was disarmed of my weapon at the scene. Okay, they took my weapon and then they let me go. The sheriff.
Wow. Well, did you have a carry permit or no?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll talk about it next week. We don't want to get into that tonight, though. Okay. Because we want to stick, we got people here for other purposes to discuss things, but we have to try to stay on point. Okay?
much.
Thank you. Okay, we'll take our next caller, which is Jamie. You got the mic. Go right ahead.
Hey, John. Would I be able to see some of this, some of these principles in action in the Northern Virginia, any Northern Virginia courthouse?
When you say see or execute it yourself, what do you mean?
Oh, well, yeah, I have to execute it myself, but I also want to go see like what happens and how these things handle.
Well, not many people know what we know, and not many people are doing the strategy that we do. I mean, we're fully common law, and there's processes and things, you know, that we just recently come upon. You know,
yes.
For instance, one of the things which we've done is a quo warranto to the United States, ultimately the whole government, but we'll focus in on the judiciary. And, you know, they haven't responded properly to that. But that's okay. We're building a case. We've filed hundreds of papers since then, literally. And that could be found on our website also underneath the federal court case on the top right-hand side on the blue bar at National Liberty Alliance. But... you know, with the quo warranto, which is a requirement to them to respond back within 15 days, okay, and they need to give us their bond, their oath, and their financials. And if they refuse to do that, then we take it to the next process. And instead of going into the courts with that part of the process, we can then move that part of the process into the bonding company. We'll then see the violation and we'll pay out the damages from that. For instance, if you've lost your home or something of that nature through a mortgage, a non-judicial foreclosure, maybe it's through mortgage or tax or other things, and you do a quo warranto in courts and they don't respond, you can then push through the bonding. And you can still pursue the case in the courts because there's other things that need to be addressed. But you can get some good satisfaction. I don't know what the limit is on that. I'm still learning on that. For some reason, I'm thinking $250,000, but I'm not sure. And we're writing two papers. We're writing a paper for dealing with this with people who are in power and authority, and you're not in the court, where you serve them sort of a notice and demand letter, and they have so many days to respond, then you can go to and pull their bond. If they don't respond and start to correct their problem, pull their bond. And again, there's a certain amount of money you can get. Up to a certain amount anyway. But then if you're in the court, then you do it with a quo warranto, and then you deal with the bonding company outside of the court, but you're still going to pursue the rest of the court issue for whatever your wherefore clause is expiring. And I'm not too sure exactly how to work that out yet, and I'm still studying that, and I was hoping to have that solution by now, but maybe another week or so, we'll see what happens.
Okay, is there someone that I could pay to help me out with that?
To do what?
Well, it sounds like I might have to do something like that. What I heard...
If you want to put a joinder in with us, we can take your joinder. We ask for a donation of $100 or more, and we'll run your papers. We kind of stopped that at the moment, but I'm hoping to get that back going in the next week or so. Hopefully, the next couple of weeks, I hope. But our problem is help. We don't have enough help.
Gotcha.
That's our problem. But we'll see what happens in the next. You can send some information. You can send it to intake@nationallibertyalliance.org. And I know Jim still gets the mail, and he'll probably send you an intake paper, and you can send it back and we'll find somebody at some point to be able to address it and work with it, and we'll communicate with you.
Sounds good. Thank you.
All right. Okay, we're going to take our next question. We have Asalu from Montana, is it?
Yes, from Missouri.
Missouri. Okay.
Yes.
M.O.
Yes. Good evening, John.
How you doing?
I'm good. Good. I do have a question on the jury, administration courses that you was talking about that we need to take. I did take the constitutional course, and I finished that, and then I start on, I believe, on the civic, but I didn't finish that, but I'm on the, government by consent.
Okay,
so I haven't finished those two.
Okay, well, if you go under the courses, it's under educational starts here, and the first tab down is courses. When you highlight that, you can see we have a foundational study, which is, you know, there's no real questions in that. It's just watching videos. And it's a real good primer for what you're about to get involved with as far as a constitutional course and free civics course. Anybody who takes that foundational study, I think they're going to be so impressed in what common law is and what we're doing here that they're going to want to continue in their courses, I should hope. But anyway, all the courses are listed here. The Constitution course, 101, which is an introduction to the Constitution, free civics course, government by consent course, free militia course, then there's the jury administrator accredited course. Now, I see the civics course is set up twice. I'll have to see what that's about. That's an error somewhere. But anyway, the jury administrator's accredited course should be the last course you take, and that you have to take that one in order to become a jury administrator. And you could be taking that as you're going through the process. We're all going through the School of Hard Knocks, so it's on-the-job training. We'll be writing, printing up a handbook, which we've gathered a lot of information on it yet, but I have not actually put it together yet. Hopefully very soon, within the next few weeks to a month, hopefully I'll get that done. But that particular book, handbook, will be sort of a step-by-step of the duties and what you're doing and the mindset and, you know, how to be careful not to taint the jury yourself and to make sure nobody else taints the jury. We're going to have a lot of information in there. But joining to those two books, to that book, there are two other books. And one is the handbook for the petit jury and the handbook for the grand jury, which then, again, can be found under Starter Committee of Safety and come down to handbooks and tools and let's see what it says. Come down to handbooks and tools. And if you click on that, then you will find the handbooks I'm talking about. But if you did want a pocket handbook, you can purchase it. And here's the information. If you click on them, it'll take you out to Amazon where you can buy it. Okay. But so continue your education. Continue doing what you have to do. What we finally have set up is, the oversight to the jury administrators will be the Committee of Safety. So if there is a problem with an individual or something, they will deal with it and they will make the decision, and their decision will be final. They will have a judiciary committee going. You'll have to go through an accredited course, which is that final course. We're going to be giving up certificates for that so that the people in the committees of safety know that you've been certified in order to take on this job and that you've received the handbook in order to lead you through the process and assist you. And that's where they end, they end, is to make sure that people are qualified and in there. But should there be a problem with an individual and they can't settle it, you know, there'll be five administrators, which is actually four administrators and someone who understands a little bit about the law. And so it'll be five of them all together. And so if there's a problem where someone is breaking their oath or they're problematic, they can bring their issue. If they can't settle it, they can bring their issue to the Judiciary Committee and the Committee of Safety and in their county. And they will settle the problem, and their decision will be final. They'll make sure people are qualified or being qualified, taking their courses. They'll be responsible for that. That's the responsibility we're going to give to those people. But we'll be monitoring it too, and I'm sure they'll be addressing the problems with us to some degree, and we'll assist in any way we can. So paralegal was the word I was looking for. So four administrators and a paralegal, but the paralegal should also be an administrator to fill in themselves also. Okay?
Okay. And also, you say that you need some volunteer, a couple hours. I have a couple hours, like on Thursday evening. Is that?
That'd be great.
Would that work?
Yes, we use help anywhere we can get it. Send an email. Terry, you want to be taking these? You're saying? Because I saw I was going to send them to Jan.
No, Senator Jan, Bill was an exception because he lives in Colorado like I do.
Okay. All right. Just send an email to Jan, J-A-N, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Okay, give him your name and phone number and tell him what you're interested in. And I'm sure he'll get back to you pretty soon, but he may not have an answer. But he'll really want to know what it is that you'd like to do, or give you some options or whatever. And again, you can go to our page here underneath Start a Committee of Safety, come down to District Coordinator's page, and you can see some of the positions that we're looking to fill. But even, you know, we just got a lot of different things we need to work on. We have a lot of secretarial type things, organizing, putting things together and pulling information out, putting it into spreadsheets, that kind of thing for the court systems. So if you have any of those skills, that'd be good. But, you know, even with no skills, there's things you can do. We'll train, you know, we're all on the job training, myself included.
Sound good. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay.
All right.
We'll take our next question. Next person is Andrew Media. How you doing?
Hey, what's up, John?
Good.
Well, I think you probably answered one question already to my disappointment.
Okay.
I was hoping you had an answer about that other document for the Coronto.
Yeah. Well, I got both. I got the letter done, almost done, and I've got the Coronto, which pretty much is what is in the book anyway. But we're going to be adding some little things in there. We're going to add more law equity, some statutes in there that give it some power and some clout. And there's a few other things we're working on it there. And again, I had a meeting with an individual who understands on how this bond system works and getting the financials and the oaths and the process and the procedure and the amount of monies you can get and pulling their bonds. So I had my first meeting with that individual, and I'm going to have another conversation with them soon. I just have to finish my research. I'm really working through some of the law part to make sure that I understand how those things work and what they got, and the meaning of different terms, and to make sure that we're understanding the terms correctly. You know, everything we do, it's very frustrating when I do research, because I get a lot of garbage when I do research, and I got to just dig through all the garbage. You know, you get a lot of opinions, and you know what opinions are like. You need the facts. I mean, everybody has an opinion, but nobody gives the facts. They don't give the where they got this information from, you know. So they need to put footnotes in their work, and they don't do it. We need to learn to do that, and we need to do it so that people can read what we're doing and looking at and see, hey, there's the authority, no doubt. This is what it means. And they can move forward, and they have good education, and they're planting their brain things that are correct and true. But you go ahead.
All right, the other question is, okay, I heard you say something about default in the notice of demand, because I've been doing those even since before we met, and I have defaults. But remember I told you, the problem is this, okay, you can't pull bonds that don't exist. Now what?
Well, that's a whole different story. That's, again, I'm working on that. I can't get into that. I mean, I can give you some of my opinions. You know opinions are like, so forget about it. I try to be, you know, on point with facts and authorities with everything I do. So the debate is over when the conclusions are clear. You know what I mean? And so it's clear to me before I can really start talking about it. So,
all right, so you only have a letter done, right?
I got two letters. I've got two letters which are got the framework ready. I haven't got the conclusion to it yet, but I think I'll have that done by next week. We can talk next week. We'll see. Okay.
Okay, then.
All right. Thank you.
I guess that's it. All right.
We'll talk next week anyway, I'm sure.
All right, then.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right, we'll take next caller. Next caller is Felicia from Florida. How you doing, Felicia?
Been in better places. My battery's dying, but I have a couple of questions. My first question is, if your house is paid off, can a HOA steal your house?
Even if it isn't paid off, they can't steal your house, because they have to do it through... Look, there's a reason why they have this non-judicial foreclosure. Just think of the words I'm saying, non-judicial foreclosure. And they do it in a court without a judge's signature, without a final decision by the court, because they can't do that, because why are they going through a non-judicial foreclosure? because they can't go through a court of justice to take your home away because the bank doesn't have the power or the authority. There is no contract with the bank. The bank is only really an intermediate. They set up the process between the loan and the, you know, the Fed window, and they're done. But they've been collecting money on this. Of course, a piece of that goes to the Fed, and so it's a game they got going. You pay for your house two or three times over by the time you get to the end of the day. So they do a non-judicial foreclosure because there is really no contract. That's the whole deal about this thing. So, no, they can't take it. They will try, and they have accomplished it. They've taken homes away from people who even have paid it off. But that's going to end soon, you know. By next year, things is going to be a whole new world. Because devolution, once it plays completely out, then we return back to a republic and back to a constitutional nation again. It's up to the people to make sure it's brought that way by having, you know, government by consent and understanding it and making it happen. And it all happens on the grassroots level. Doesn't happen on a national level. Not at all. National Liberty Alliance can't. We can make the battle in the courtroom, but to some degree. But it's the people who have to take the government control at the grassroots level. That's where they have to be. And that's what we're teaching people to do.
Okay. My second question is, I've been with NLA since 2017. I did all the paperwork. I filed the show cause. I do have the paperwork of the judge telling me I have to get out. I have video of the sheriff using the local police to come and break into my home. And now my car broke down and I'm pretty much homeless and nowhere to go. And, I hear about these surety bonds and, you know, I know I'm ignorant to the fact.
I believe you've done a joinder with us, right?
I did.
Yeah.
And I submitted the paperwork to
to the
lawyers, to the judges, to the sheriff, to the real estate people last year.
We will be communicating again. You know, we're working on that right now. We're hoping to get that done within the next couple of months to bring it into the courts to get this settled and to pull the bonds off these people. And you know, even if these people don't have a bond, then you know what happens. There's other people that are responsible. The system in itself is responsible. Here in New York, for instance, not one judge has a bond, from what I understand. And I found this out through the judges, a group of judges ultimately that run the whole system. I forget what their titles were. It's been a while since I thought or had communications with them. But they finally, you know, admitted to me, well, look, judges don't really have a bond. They're backed up by, ultimately, the state, which means we're paying for it. You're paying for it. And that's unlawful. But there's other ways to trace. We will trace those things down to deal with that problem as we go forward, because they'll have to be done the same way. A bonding company is going to look at it, or should be looking at it, from a different perspective. And honestly, they see the violation and they pay out on it, period, end of subject. Okay. As long as you went through the process of trying to, you know, correct that problem, and that's what we've done with filing the papers that we've done, and your papers are in there, so you'll be part of that. And if you can give us any assistance in any way and work with us on the national level, that's fine. And if you can't, that's fine too. But we will be making contact with you eventually through email. You've got to work an email, I hope, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So as long as we have that. Again, we'll be contacting people, and we need people to respond to us. If people aren't responding to us, it's a problem, you know. So
I can do the best that I can, but I'm just trying not to live on the street, you know.
Understood. I've been there myself many years ago. I was in that kind of a situation. I was homeless for a short period of time, and it's a very horrible thing. I understand it.
Yeah. Also, the last show calls that I submitted is being blocked on their website.
What was it being blocked?
The show cause.
Oh, okay.
That I submitted.
Yeah, that doesn't matter. That's a crime. We'll deal with that. That's what the whole court case is about, what we're doing. We're making the point. The reason why we're doing joinders is a couple of reasons. Number one, we're trying to help people, you know, to get their homes back, to be left alone, particularly for that. Habeas corpuses, those were the two focuses. We did do some other court cases, but we really were focusing on those two things, people losing their homes and losing their liberty. And so we figure, okay, on one hand, we can be helping the people. On the other hand, we're building a case and showing conspiracy, because everything's happening the same way, no matter where you are. Whatever district you're in, whatever state you're in, all the courts are operating the same way, and they're operating unlawfully. And that in itself is a crime. And that's why we're suing the judiciary, particularly the United States Supreme Court also, and the judiciary, because look at the United States Supreme Court is responsible to make sure that these courts are operating under law and equity, and they're not doing their job. So, but
I had a local cop tell me that I assume after I submitted the show cause, he told me that my case would never see a day in court.
Well, we'll see about that. Okay. Well, I differ with him, because he doesn't know what we're doing, and it will go back into the case, into the courts, and I do believe at the end of the day we all will get justice. I feel pretty confident about that. Because we're going to we're going back into a republic. Look at, you know, anybody that's been listening very carefully to Trump, if you haven't heard all of his, you know, speeches and different things, you might miss this or that or the other thing. But he was very, very clear. And I remember this one thing he did, and he went on for quite some time. It was almost like a mantra in his speech, you know, never give up. We'll never give up. Okay? And he means that. You know that. And the best is yet to come. You know, and we've got it all. We caught them all. I mean, listen to those statements he's making, okay? And there was a declaration. There was a declaration of independence that he had written back in, I believe it was 2020, July 4th, 2020, his last year in office, and he wrote a declaration of independence similar to the Declaration of Independence, laying out the deep state and the problems, the New World Order, the whole thing. I'm working on trying to get the actual copy with a signature. We do have, I'll be posting the video once I get the copy. Until then, I'm not going to post the video, though.
But okay, that, I have one more question.
Okay, go ahead. One quick question, because there's a few people.
One quick question. Yeah. Okay, the real estate agent put a notice on my door, and he said that I was a tenant and he was a landlord, and I needed to pay a certain amount of money, and then he didn't put the date. Something like that. How is
it
that?
First of all, look at you. First of all,
the judges can allow that.
No, first of all, it's got to be an official paper through the court system. Why don't you come talk with us next week and next Monday, and we'll go into more details. But the bottom line is that if the sheriff doesn't show up, you don't have to go nowhere.
The sheriff showed up. If I'm not mistaken, he keeps
that gun for him. Then what happened is they went through the whole process. And have changed the control of your home from you to someone else, and the real estate agents, I don't know what involvement they got in this. It's usually the banks, you know, it becomes a problem, and they treat you as a tenant at that point. And if you look at your mortgage papers anyway, you'll find out you're listed as a tenant anyway. You never did.
I have a copy of the deed.
Yeah, well, in that deed, you'll find out that you read through that deed, you're referred to as a tenant. But we'll talk about that more next week if you want. I just want to move on. We don't have much more time for today. And
okay.
Stay on point.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, we're going to be shutting down in a few minutes, but I'm going to try to take whatever I can. I want to move through as quick as I can. Samuel, is that the next caller there, 214 number? Five 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 eight. You got the mic. Okay, we'll go to the next caller. Bay, B-E-Y, you got the mic.
All right, thank you. I just had a question I wanted to know. I came across a document. It's called the House Resolution 0689. It's the 97th Assembly. Uh-huh. And so it's on the Illinois government website, and it says that there were people here during the biblical days. So for I guess thousands of years, I don't know, and that they governed this land theocratically. And so I was wondering, are you aware of that, or is there any weight to that government?
Yeah, I don't understand that at all, but if you send a link to that information to mail, M-A-I-L, at nationallibertyalliance.org, I'll keep an eye out for it. And be also, there's a lot of people that get email to that mail, M-A-I-L, at National Liberty Alliance, and people will deal with different things as it comes through, but they can get educated on that too, and I'll keep an eye open for it, and maybe we could talk about it next week or following week, whenever you want.
Okay. So you said mail at National Liberty Alliance?
M-A-I-L, mail at nationallibertyalliance.org.
Okay. All right.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to take our next question. Joan, J-O-H-N-E, Johnny, I guess, Utah.
Yeah, hey, it's just me, John. I don't have a question. I wanted to take the mic for a few minutes. Maybe we can put me on the agenda or something for next Monday.
So okay.
I don't keep people. I don't want to keep everybody tonight, but we've been on here a while.
All right, yeah.
The stuff that Ed and I is doing and kind of...
Yeah, that's a good idea. Why don't we pick you up? We'll pick you up first and foremost in the beginning when we do... questions, email questions and announcements, and then we'll pick you up right after that. So we'll get to you in the beginning.
Okay.
Just get into the queue right away, okay? And I'll keep an eye out for you. And Jen, make a note if you can to remember, or Terry, make a note to remember to keep an eye out for John from Utah.
Thank you.
Sure.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Okay, we'll take our next caller. Let's see. Next question is Ross. You got the mic. You only got a minute or two. Go right ahead.
Hello, this is Ross. I'm wondering, because I'm looking at Sovereignty International website about getting the lives. Certificate of life birth.
Yep. The certificate of live birth. What about it?
Yes. Should people go through that process and get that certificate of live birth or not?
Well, you know, that's a good question on that. That's the process that we have set up. I don't know. You know, well, it seems important. I'll tell you what, I haven't given a lot of thought on that. I know when I talk to Brent next time, I'll bring that up to him, see what his thoughts are on that. But I just haven't given enough thought on that. I know it's problematic. That used to not always be.
Yeah.
You know, people were born and, a lot of people, their birth was recorded in the family Bible. And that's how they kept track of people, birth and proof of birth. By going to the family Bible, there they are, one on that day. Now, they do have certificates, and that brings us into that whole thing process was set up in order to create us as being equal to chattel, which is livestock, and we're being bought and sold, that's what's going on with that whole system. Should we continue that? Well, that's something I guess we have to debate, we have to think about, and look at the pros and cons of that, and I just haven't thought enough about it to give a real good opinion on it. Okay.
Because that's the only way you can get your passport. Yes, passport.
Without a social security number, without a birth certificate, without a driver's license, you can't live life without those things. And I know those people who are pushing, the man on the land stuff and saying, become free and do this and get rid of your birth certificate, get rid of your driver's license and your social security. Hey, we need to get rid of a lot of that anyway to begin with, but it's not going to do you any good right now. Number one, you're flagging yourself as a patriot to the extreme, and I don't want to say it's bad, but it's not necessary to begin with. We don't need driver's licenses, and eventually that will come to play. We'll be dealing with that. Birth certificates, I really don't opinion at the moment. And Social Security numbers, I think we need to get rid of them too. But again, I haven't really got a lot of thought. There is some need, it seems, for it, but I haven't thought it out enough to really have a good conclusion on that yet. But they all are problematic. Okay. Send me what?
Do you want me to send the link of the Sovereignty International?
Yes, send it to mail. Yeah, send it to mail, M-A-I-L, at nationallibertyalliance.org, and I'll keep an eye out for it. Okay?
Okay, I will do that.
And then maybe we could talk about it again. But I don't have a good conclusion. I haven't thought enough about it. So. Okay, we'll take our next question. Thanks, Ross. We've got a couple of more people I want to try to get through. But I got to get out of here in a few minutes. I got to pick my son up from work. He's getting off, and I pick him up at this time. But Dan from North Carolina, you got the mic? Got a minute?
Absolutely. We can't do justice. We don't have enough time. But I will assure you folks that knowing this organization, National Liberty Alliance, has helped so many countless people, and they have so many different ways to do so. One thing for sure, I heard earlier this lady, I want that comfort zone to be sent to this lady, that first and foremost, one of the ways that National Liberty Alliance, that I know firsthand, will challenge and bring in any of these people that are a bunch of criminals trying to take you and run you out of your own home as to where they violate the Fifth Amendment. That is due process of law, lady. And in case you do not know this, the bankers that you might have dealt with, they did not lend any of their monies. This is how you can be, but you have to go through John and Drash and you know, Mr. Jerry Apria and the rest of the guys are so knowledgeable. They call the shots.
The key thing ultimately, you know, people who want to deal with their problems and take care of it, and you should be able to take your own problems and not go to a bar attorney, you know, get the book. Court access in the common law, and then you can come and ask questions, and we can talk some more about it, and you can learn how to take care of it yourself. Now, I know people are in an emergency situation, but I will tell you one thing. When I went to study the process of law, I got a course that I got, I'm trying to think of the name of it, but in any event, I got this course. And I buckled down on Friday night, and I spent until Sunday throughout the day, Fridays, Saturday and Sunday, and I went through the whole thing, made lots of notes, and got all of the structure into my brain with lots of notes and cutting up all of the different, you know, papers and putting them in orders and so on and so forth. It was all PDFs, putting them in nice orders so that I can utilize them, and I worked things out to come to a reasonably good understanding in a quick way. So if you really need to do it, I will tell you, that if you get the book, Court Access and the Common Law, sit down, buckle down, and read it as a book. Forget to use it to try to figure it out yet. Just read it as a book. And then go back, after you finish reading the book, go back to the beginning, start all over, and start taking notes. Because now you'll have a basic idea and a roundabout understanding of what the book is and how it's put together. So that by the time you go back to go through it the second time, now you can start taking notes and a lot of the information you'll find it is, and I think it's well organized, and it's a process, and it becomes a book that's a reference book to you. But you can start to get the notes. You'll see the anatomy of a court case, which is one chapter, gives you all the papers that's required in order to file a case in the courts, how to open up a court of record, the proper language to use, a good mindset. I mean, I think it was chapter one or two that's the anatomy. I think it's two that's the anatomy of the court of a court case. And it goes all the way down to the trial, okay? So you can do it quickly. You could probably do it in a couple of weeks if you've got that drive to do that. If you got a drive to do it, you can do it. And again, like anything else, the more time you spend with it, the better you become and more knowledgeable of it. But go ahead, Dan, finish up. I got two other callers, and I want to try to get
real quickly, folks, to add to what Mr. John just said, you rest assured there is a powerhouse of what he's done and blazed the trail, folks, the paperwork, how, for example, to remove from some of these corrupt criminal courts. and remove it with cause, and that is to federal court. And, of course, you have to have a cause, and that cause, simplest way to beat them at their game is that they violated your Fifth Amendment, which is due process of law. And that lady just a while ago, everything I heard from her, she's had no due process of law.
Absolutely. So that's the key point is due process. That's what they violate when they violate any of your unalienable rights. But go ahead, finish off.
And real quickly, folks, I'll promise you this. This will kill them. But you want to go let Mr. John DeRash and Jerry Priya and his team, not Dan Stanlin here, you want to go to them. They have the documents in-house, and they're proven. And they'll be the best thing you can ever do for your cause. Now, listen, real quickly. What a lot of people don't know is this, that these banks, they do not lend and have not lent one square nickel to any of you people that are being subjected to the sheriffs and all these, what that lady said a while ago. The truth of the matter is the banks, they take your own credit and turn around and collateralize it, and they loan your own credit in the way of a form of a loan. And this is one of the secrets right there as to that Mr. John DeRash and his team will certainly know. Last nickel is this. Whether you believe this or not, ever since March 1933, this nation has been in bankruptcy, folks. And the fiat money that man that was there at that lady's house she was talking about a while ago earlier demanding, that is a criminal demand, because that whoever he was, supposedly sheriff in closing here, he was demanding fraudulent, which is called fiat monies, for her, and he was bullying her and harassing her, and he could be charged for harassment, and he was asking of her of something that has no substance and could not pay off a debt anyway. And so the truth of the matter is this has been a fiasco. You stay in touch and look inside the archives of National Liberty Alliance. These people have got you covered. Get the book that Mr. John was just referring to. And I'll say one thing, and that is this. In case you don't know it, Mr. Jerry Apria, we need to veer to him next Monday night and let him walk us through, especially some of you folks, as to, I'm just going to quote this one word, and I'm not going to say anything about it because we got other people here.
Yeah,
we
got to move on.
Yes, sir. Nasara, you get Mr. Jerry, ask questions about him next week, and he will unveil and open your eyes. One last thing, I want to
move on, Dan, because I got two other people I got to leave.
Okay, I want to ask you a quick question, and you need, and that's for next week. And that is the idea of where some of us that are a little bit polished could bring a commercial lien against these people, fraudulent so-called judges and courts and all this stuff. You can
we deal with bonds. That's the key. Need a commercial lien. That's a different process.
True.
So.
True. All right, I
got to go.
We got other people.
Okay, next caller. I only got a minute or two here. Bay, don't know how. Go right ahead.
Thank you so much. Okay, this may be a lengthy question, so you don't have to answer it if you don't want to. But on the last call, you guys mentioned talk to the sheriff. And so I didn't get to ask this question last time, but have you guys picked the sheriff's brain to try and get an idea why some of the sheriffs don't want to follow the Constitution or what they're afraid of?
Yeah, the problem with them is they're following the county attorney and they have no knowledge of who they are, what their powers and authorities really are. Some of them do, but and some of them that do don't really even know the full breadth of their powers. They got so much power. They control everything, anything that goes through the court system within that county, any agency that comes into that county, any kind of a warrant served. The sheriff is the guy to do it, and he should have the understanding of a knowledge of what a constitutional warrant is. And he should be kicking out of his county any federal agent that comes in to try to serve a warrant, because most of those, maybe there are some warrants, of course, that would be valid. It's up to him to look at. And he's got to make sure that they come to him before they go serve the warrant. And he's got to be there in the serving of the warrant and make sure it's done in an orderly and lawful fashion. But these sheriffs don't know it. That's why we have the Campaign for Constitutional Sheriffs, where we're sending a book to every sheriff in America. There's over 3,000 of them. And we need people to buy a book for their sheriff. So please go out to nationallibertyalliance.org. On the right side, you'll see,
link or whatever.
Yeah, it's a link that says Campaign for Constitutional Sheriffs. So click on that, buy your sheriff a book, okay? And when we send that sheriff a book, we have a sheriff that's working with us, Sheriff Dar. He has written a letter that we put into that book to that sheriff to sheriff, and we write a letter, a one-page letter, and give them some information of how this book came about being for them and that the people paid for it, for them to have a proper education and so on and so forth. So
okay,
that's where we're beginning. Go ahead.
Like, if they got the book and still got problems, that's what I want to know.
Well, if they got the book and they read the preface, okay, of that book, and that didn't interest them enough to go reading that book, okay, then they don't belong being a sheriff. That book is so rock solid with footnotes, everything there has an authority. Every word spoken has an authority. So if they can't see that, then they don't deserve being a sheriff and they need to be gotten rid of. But look, we can educate our sheriffs and we can entice them to take a look at this. And again, between the letter from one sheriff, the letter from us, and the preface in the book, they should be excited about that because it's given them power and authority, which they should understand and exercise. So, but if you want to discuss this further, let's talk next week, okay? Because I got one of the persons.
You haven't come across any sheriff that got the book and was like, no, I'm not going to do it. I'm too scared.
Oh, I haven't. Well, we had one sheriff send a book back. Matter of fact, I'm going to call his office to find out why. But other than that, I'm not aware of a sheriff that actually made any objections to it. And remember, that's why it was important for us to have a sheriff working with us. So it's sheriff to sheriff. A sheriff talking to another sheriff puts his phone number, his address. He's a sheriff. You want to talk to me, you know, give me a call. But the thing is he wrote a letter introducing the book and saying, hey, get out your pencils and papers, start taking notes, and let's start exercising the law.
Okay, great. Okay.
Any sheriff who goes to an attorney to get advice in order to execute the law, with the exception of process, okay, process is understanding. But as far as interpreting the law, he doesn't deserve being a sheriff. Now, he doesn't know that maybe. He doesn't, he's as ignorant as we were or are. And, I speak to myself first. I was very ignorant in these things, but I've educated myself. Now I know. Well, that's what he has to do, and he will have his, his Helen Keller moment, so to speak.
Okay, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Okay, last caller, Linda from Virginia. Go right ahead.
Hello, this is Linda in Virginia.
How you doing, Linda?
Good. Maybe you can refer. I'm following up to the gentleman from North Carolina, South Carolina, or wherever, and
yep.
The woman. Maybe you can refresh my memory, but notwithstanding the joinder,
right.
on judicial foreclosures. If the sheriff shows up on the doorstep and there's no contract, if the banks have no contracts, who is signing off on the affidavits?
Well, it's a game they play. I can't get too much into it, but the end result is by the time the bank uses the process of nonjudicial foreclosures, they go through these exercises of things, which actually takes many years to do. People need to realize that you got years, but as long as you keep going to that court and complaining and say, hey, what are you talking about? But I can't get too much into it. But the bottom line is, when it comes down for the sheriff, as far as he's concerned, he's just having you, thrown out because you're a tenant, you're not paying your rent, and you're out of there. That's what he thinks. And the court sends him out. And with that phone call coming in, I got to go. I am way over time.
Who is signing the affidavits? Can't we sue them? Can't we bring suit against them?
Talk to me next Monday. We can go into that, yes. Okay, I really got to go. I'm 20. My son's sitting 20 minutes waiting for me from pick him up. I got to go. All right?
Sounds good. All right.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Bye.
Okay, with that, we're going to end our program. Hopefully everybody will be back next Monday, Lord willing. We'll see you then. And good night, everybody. Thanks for coming.